This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Thank you for joining us on our Main Street across the state of North Dakota this time of day. And today, our show is going to take a bit of a serious turn, at least at the beginning, because at some point during our formative years, we become aware of mortality, the realization that human beings don't live forever. And when you get to be a certain age, and I qualify, that realization becomes more immediate. Pondering the meaning of life includes thinking about its end, death. Late last year, we talked with NDSU Professor Clay Rutledge about his provocative book, Supernatural: Death, Meaning, and the Power of the Invisible World. Rutledge is also a psychological scientist who studies human motivation. Today, we're giving that discussion an encore. The first question we posed was, why did he write the book?
Well, I read the book in part because I'd been, this is something that I've been, these topics are something I've been studying for many years. And also, as I get into the book a little bit, there is a bit of a personal connection to me to these issues, just from my own background as the son of Baptist missionaries. And so there is this kind of like personal story, but also a very science-driven or research-driven text for sure.
Well, let's jump right into it. The first chapter is titled, We Are All Going to Die and We Know It. So
that's right.
Lead us into this discussion.
Yeah, so when I started graduate school, to study social psychology, that's my area of research, which in a nutshell is how we navigate the social world in terms of our beliefs and identities. But one of the things that really grabbed my attention was there were some researchers studying the implications of being, as far as we know, the only organism or the only animal fully aware of our mortal nature. And that is, like other organisms, we're in the, survival and reproduction game. We get up every day and we work to stay alive and to keep our children alive. And we have goals that reflect that. And that doesn't necessarily make us distinct from other species. Lots of animals are trying to survive and thrive. But we have this, highly sophisticated intellectual capacity. We're smart. We can do science. We can do all sorts of cool things. But that also renders us uniquely aware of our mortal fragility. So as far as we know, we're the only organism that can really turn inward, really introspect in a deep way about our mortal predicament and what it means to be alive and what it means to face death.
Well, let's lead on to the next thing. I've read from the slipcover in the book, there's a note here that exploring research from the emerging field of experimental existential psychology. What is that?
That's right. Yeah, so that's the area of research I'm in. And, so like I said, it's kind of part of a broader field of social psychology about how we navigate the social world. But what experimental existential psychology specifically focused on are these unique existential questions that humans can ask. So my dog doesn't, as far as I'm aware, ask what the meaning of his life is. He seems pretty content to just, to just be comforted by social connections and to eat food and to play and to, explore the yard. But we turn inward and we spend a considerable amount of our energy wondering about our nature and what it means to be a species that on the one hand is nearly godlike in what we can invent, but on the other hand, chained to biology and thus mortal.
Yes. So is this the basis for religion and our attraction to the supernatural?
Yeah, so this is one of the theories of the foundation of religion is that it's based in humans really grappling with existential questions. And these existential questions don't just influence how we think about ourselves, they influence how we think about our relationships too, because the other component of being human is being highly social, right? We know that we really, really thrive when we have connections and that when people are lonely, it's almost like a social death, right? They feel insignificant. And so a good portion of religion isn't just about me trying to make sense out of my life, but me trying to maintain enduring connections to other people that transcend, ideally, death.
Are there answers to existential questions, or is the value just in asking the question?
Well, so, that's a tough one because a lot of our answers to these questions are highly subjective, right? What you might say gives your life meaning might not be the same thing that gives my life meaning. I mean, you might get a lot of meaning from reading books and traveling and all sorts of other things, and I might get meaning from something else entirely. So it's difficult to, you know, to make objective comparisons. But what people like me can do who study these things empirically is we can test not only what are the things that people invest in to find meaning, but to what extent those things actually seem to do a good job of providing meaning. And that's where we can make some interesting comparisons between different sources of meaning.
How do you conduct research for a book like this?
So the research is part of it's historical. You know, I get into kind of the history of different sorts of belief systems a little bit. A lot of it is experimental. Earlier you said something about experimental existential psychology. So what does that experimental part mean? Well, that means largely that we bring people into the laboratory to where we can control, you know, more tightly what they're thinking about and what they're doing. And so we might subject some people to certain types of conditions in which they're thinking about heavy topics like death and meaning. And other people in a control condition might be thinking about something else that we think is matched on other variables such as emotion. But that doesn't implicate these existential concerns. And then we can see how they respond to these sorts of cues. And so a lot of the book I kind of walk people through in a very accessible way. It's not very jargony, in a very, you know, a way that most people could read and understand. I walk people through how we've done some of these experiments and what are some of the outcomes of them.
Clay Rutledge is the author of Supernatural Death, Meaning, and the Power of the Invisible World. What's the invisible world?
So the invisible world, I actually got this term from a cultural anthropologist named Ernest Becker, who won the Pulitzer Prize in General Nonfiction in 1973 or 74, I believe, for his book, The Denial of Death. And he uses this concept in that book called the invisible world, which is basically the world outside of what we can measure empirically, at least what we can measure now. So these are supernatural or kind of paranormal or, you know, some sort of forces or qualities that are difficult, if not impossible, to measure, you know, through science. And it seems like there's a considerable amount of human attention that goes into these things, that thinks about the spiritual realm or the supernatural realm, and that doesn't require evidence to do so. So this is what I mean by we invest in the invisible world. We invest in the material world, of course, too, but there's a considerable amount of energy that goes into thinking about the spiritual or the non-material.
Well, in the realm of the experimental existential psychologist, are religion and the supernatural the same kind of thing?
So that's a really tricky question. You could bring 20 experts in here and get 21 different answers. Because, you know, some sociologists will say, well, religion really is more of a social, cultural phenomenon. And then some psychologists will say, well, no, religion is about thoughts and ideas, supernatural ideas in particular. So it's very much up for debate. But clearly, many of the world's religions historically have involved the supernatural. Of course, people also have supernatural beliefs, such as belief in ghosts, and they wouldn't say that they're religious. But the two seem to be connected or correlated in some way, for sure.
Is there something healthy about believing in a religion or the supernatural?
So one of the chapters in my book is dedicated entirely to this, because there is, you know, decades and decades of pretty substantial research indicating that religious beliefs can be quite healthy for people, not just in terms of psychological or mental health, but also in terms of physical health. People who are strong believers, devout believers, tend to live healthier and longer lives. And we could get into all the complexities of why that might be the case. And there's certainly religious beliefs and supernatural beliefs that can be dangerous, right? So there are, you know,
Jim Jones and Guyana.
Yeah, exactly. So there are small kind of cultish groups that have supernatural beliefs that push them away from science and medicine. But that seems to be the exception to the rule, not, you know, sort of not the norm.
What about religion's role in governance? I mean, didn't the first kinds of human government sort of revolve around a sort of theology?
Yeah, I mean, I don't talk about this much in the book, but there is definitely kind of this intersection between politics and religion that is complex and tricky. I mean, one of the things I think that's interesting about the emergence of the more individualistic West is we've moved away from theocracy, right? We have more of this balance of secular governments and then, you know, kind of private religious lives. And there certainly seems to be some benefits and some challenges associated with that. But one of the arguments I make in the book and in other writings I've done is just because society is becoming more secular in how we govern ourselves doesn't mean that this religious realm or the supernatural realm has diminished as much as people think it has.
It just sort of evolves or manifests itself in different ways?
Yeah, that's right. I think what happens is when people – like you can look at statistics like in the people leaving the church in America. Traditional religious identification is dramatically in decline in the U.S. But at the same time, belief in other sorts of supernatural ideas is increasing. So more people believe in ghosts today than they did 20 years ago. In fact, people who don't attend church regularly are twice as likely to believe in ghosts as regular church attendees. So you see these phenomenon that I often refer to as like the substitution argument, which is as people leave one type of belief behind, they don't tend to abandon all beliefs entirely. Most people at least don't. They tend to start investing in other supernatural ideas.
What about the inclination for us to sort of have a divinity, personify the religious belief or the supernatural belief in a god or Mother Earth, Gaia, or something like that?
Yeah, that's right. No, you nailed it. I mean, so you can even look at polls and see why there's an increasing number of people who don't believe in a traditional Judeo-Christian god. Oftentimes, they believe in some other kind of universal spirit or force or multiple deities even, or they have some sense that there is like a there is some sort of cosmic connection between all of us that, almost like a unimind or something, that we all are connected to one powerful force in some meaningful way.
In the introduction to this book, you talk about your son's swimming competition and inventing this sort of super juice for everybody to drink. Is there a placebo effect to religion or belief in the supernatural that, if we believe in something good will happen, something good will happen?
I mean, I think that is definitely part of it. So we've done some research just looking at the motivational power of meaning. So when people feel like their lives are meaningful and they feel like they have a purpose, it inspires them to do things, right, which can make them feel like that meaning was right. So if you get up in the morning and you're like, oh, I've got a bunch of stuff to do today and I don't really feel that good and I would rather just sit around and play video games and drink beer or whatever – then you're not going to, fulfill a lot of goals. But if you get up every day and say, no, I have a destiny, I have a purpose, I have a reason for being here, there's a plan laid out in front of me, then you're more likely to overcome, distractions or to reject kind of hedonistic pleasures in the service of that more challenging or difficult goal. So, yeah, it does seem to be a lot of these beliefs seem to have motivational power.
Well, we touched on sort of the history of religion and governance and that kind of thing, but does religion or a belief in the supernatural help us avoid chaos and nihilism and give us some sort of an ethical and what we call a moral structure?
Yeah, definitely. So for one, there is some research linking religiosity to the more moral sides of our neural processes in our brain. So it turns out when we're thinking about things like moral laws or what we think are rights and wrongs, that sort of thinking relies on certain neural networks in our brain that also seems to be related to these kind of meaning intuitions, like what makes us feel like life is meaningful. And so these things do seem to be connected. And in fact, one of the major predictors of religious belief is what people call empathetic moral concern. The more people are worried about the welfare of others, as a general rule, the more religious they tend to be. It gets more, of course, it can get more complex than that. So there is very much a moral side of this. And second, relating to the chaos thing, this is one of the arguments for why Western society has become more secular is that it's become more safe and stable. And so it, in times of stability and when people feel relatively safe and protected, they tend to become less religious. In times of hardship or distress or anxiety, people tend to become more religious. So for instance, there was some research looking at an earthquake that happened in New Zealand. In New Zealand, like the rest of the Western world, had this decline in religion. But during this period when there was an earthquake that killed 100 and some people, they saw an increased belief in God. So when things become chaotic, people definitely turn to more religious ideas and concepts.
And as people age, they might do the same?
Yeah, I mean, there is some research looking at that. Certainly as people get older, they start thinking more about what gives their life meaning and what makes them feel part of something bigger than themselves. And they become less focused on, you know, more material things like money and fame and beauty.
Clay Rutledge is the author of Supernatural: Death, Meaning, and the Power of the Invisible World. And Clay is a professor of psychology at NDSU. You were talking about this, the human empathy and the sort of our drive to connect. Mm-hmm. One of these sort of historical manifestations of religion, and as we practice it even now, is this evangelism, wanting to share the good news, wanting to help other people better understand the mysteries of life and death as we see them.
Yeah.
Do you study that?
No, I don't actually. I don't do a lot of research on that. I know what you're talking about, of course, but yeah. But it does. That does seem to be connected to this moral concern, because if you think something is the way to have a fulfilling and meaningful life, then if you're a person who, you know, who cares about others, then you would obviously want to share those ideas.
Well, again, in that introduction, you talk about this sort of concoction your son develops for all of the kids of the swimming team to drink before they race. Is ritual important in this understanding? Is tradition connected to all of this?
Yeah, I mean, there is some research. This isn't really the work that I do, but there's certainly some research showing that one of the benefits of ritual is it provides kind of like a stable meaning system of that, you know, we know what to expect. And we like these kinds of patterns. I mean, patterns that make sense to us help give us meaning in life. But also rituals and traditions are a way to maintain a social fabric. So one of the things that we like about, Christmas is getting ready to come up, we like about our Christmas traditions and rituals is they don't just make us feel good, but they make us feel connected to people. And importantly, and we don't think about this much, but not just people in our own lives, but they connect us to people across time. They connect us to our ancestors, and we think that they're going to connect us to future people as well, right? Because we hope our children and grandchildren and great-grandchildren carry on these traditions. So in a lot of ways, traditions and rituals are ways of connecting with people temporally across, you know, across time and space.
Is there a danger, and danger is probably the wrong word here, but is there a problem with trying to apply a scientific understanding to a practice that we call religion or belief in the supernatural?
So it is a challenge because you know, one of the things that, you know, people will say, if people have kind of an intuitive negative response to you know, using science to test these things, is because they do see them as somewhat, segmented off as sacred. Like, these are not ideas that we should think about scientifically. But I think one of the benefits of studying them scientifically is it helps us understand what dimensions of these beliefs are, you know, are helpful to us, what dimensions are potentially harmful. You know, I only briefly mentioned some of the potential negative effects, but as we've seen throughout history, there are plenty of examples of religious and, to be honest, like religious-like secular enterprises that have led to great pain and suffering to many people. And so from my perspective, which, of course, I'm biased because I am a scientist who studies these things, there is a lot of value in trying to understand these things from a scientific perspective. And you can certainly do so respectfully, I believe.
And yet, as you mentioned or alluded to, a lot of people have been killed in history for not believing in the right religion.
Yeah. Correct, yeah. Yeah, so that's important too, is to understand, you know, so in the psychology of religion, you know, the area of research that I'm in, people study things like religious fundamentalism or extremism, and what are the characteristics of a person or of a particular ideology that orient people towards that and seduce people into doing, you know, horrible things. What is it about certain, you know, like extremist religious groups that advocate for terrorism, which we think of, you know, when we think of the world's religions, we think we'd like to think of them as promoting peace and harmony. Why is there some aspects of them that seem to attract people to doing great works of evil? So I think these are all important questions to study.
Well, we are, as you mentioned, pretty complex in terms of what's between our ears.
That's right.
And we're all sort of in this by ourselves. We try to communicate with others, but we have this inner life. So in the process of researching and writing this book, what did Clay Rutledge discover about himself?
So this, you know, this that's actually a good question because, you know, like a lot of people, the more I learn things, the more I kind of have to, you know, interrogate myself and update my own beliefs. And, you know, one of the things doing this research and writing this book that I guess kind of surprised me was the extent to which I think we all are religious in some way, even if we think we're not, or even if even when we think we don't have certain biases or certain intuitions that we often do. And so this is, you know, I've given a number of talks at like secular humanist conferences or even atheist or for atheist organizations. And there are people that really, really struggle with this idea. They think of themselves as not at all religious. But then, you know, you start to unpack the human mind and you start to see, well, just because you say I don't believe in X doesn't mean you don't believe in something in the same way that people do believe in X. And so kind of getting down underneath into the, you know, the basic fundamental, you know, cognitive processes of the human mind and understanding that we're actually, regardless of what we believe or don't believe, we're actually all quite, you know, a lot more similar to each other than we think we are.
Well, we're all sitting around sometimes, maybe a lot, thinking about what is the meaning of life. And yet some of us sort of let somebody else determine that, you know, ask the priest or the minister or the rabbi or, you know, the imam, determine what the meaning of life is as opposed to wrestling within ourselves.
Yeah, so there are a whole host of personality characteristics that make people more or less, you know, willing to, you know, as you suggest, you know, sort of follow other people's vision of the meaning of life versus form our own. But one of the things that that we've been finding in our research, and you know, I think people, particularly in the more secular Western cultures, don't really like to hear, but it seems to be the case, is our efforts often to find our own meaning in life aren't particularly successful. So it seems like people who are more traditionally religious or people who have more of a kind of a collectivist vision of, you know, community-focused source of meaning seem to enjoy greater meaning than people who carve out their own kind of idiosyncratic spiritual beliefs. And why would that be the case? Why shouldn't all of these beliefs equally provide meaning? And one thing that seems to help explain this is something we talked about a minute ago, which is kind of our moral concern for others, which is the more we submit to some sort of higher authority or some type of shared conception of reality, the more likely we are to feel a duty to others and to put our own individualist kind of interests and goals aside in service of the community or the collective. And that seems to provide more existential security than just doing our own thing. So there's something inherent to our social nature that the more belief can weave us together, connect us together in some way, the more meaning we get from it.
So we can go to a church and stand up when everybody is reciting the Apostles' Creed and think to ourselves, you know, that's a bit of a stretch, but it's good to be here.
Exactly. So, I mean, I think one of the things that, you know, that I think it's hard for people to imagine is that the human brain hasn't really changed tens of thousands of years. Like, we're still in the hunter-gatherer brain. And so, you know, people think that they have rationally come to some conclusion that they are not religious anymore and thus don't want to go to church or participate. But I think a more accurate explanation would be, like, the world has always been populated with people of varying beliefs. And so – but when church was the only game in town – you had the situation that you just described. You might have some people in the audience sitting there and saying, hey, you know, I don't really know if I'm into this, but we're all here together. This isn't about me. This is about us. But as our society becomes more about me and less about we, I think you will see potential crises of meaning.
Okay. Well, this is a feast for thought. The book is Supernatural: Death, Meaning, and the Power of the Invisible World. The author is Clay Rutledge. It was published by Oxford University Press out in July of this year. And Clay is an NDSU professor of psychology and a psychological scientist who studies human motivation. Thank you for spending some time with us on Main Street today.
It's great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Coming up on Main Street, we'll share a commentary from Mark Trahant about a proposal for a Green New Deal. And we'll talk with the grants manager for Newman's Own Foundation about some timely support for Prairie Public. First, the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. Authorities are warning the public about a dangerous social media challenge that targets young people. The Minnesota Sheriff's Association and other agencies say it's called the 48 Hours Missing Challenge, which has teens daring each other to go missing for 2 days in the hope that family and friends will make social media posts about their disappearance. The person who gets their post shared the most times is the winner. Officials say the challenge is not only dangerous to the participant, but it could tie up first responders while real emergencies are happening. Grand Forks police are not amused by recent complaints over some funny money that has shown up around town. Authorities are saying that they have received several complaints about counterfeit $100 bills being passed at several area businesses. Police Department Lieutenant Brett Johnson says the bogus bills look and feel like the real deal, but there is a small symbol on the left and right side of the front of the bogus bucks. Johnson reminds businesses to scrutinize any large denomination bills that they take and that the bills may pass the marker test. The Grand Forks Police Department has collected images of a suspect vehicle and will be releasing additional information in the coming days. And next Friday, February 22nd, is crossover day at the legislature. That's when the bills from one chamber are to be acted on and either sent to the other chamber or killed. The legislature is then on crossover break until the following Wednesday, but the two chambers are hoping to have a little extra time off. The Senate is planning to recess next Wednesday. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Cupid, draw back your bow.
Those fun candy conversation hearts may be no more, but this Valentine's Day, you can still send some of the organizations you believe in.
Message of love.
And we hope one of them is Prairie Public. This February 14th, Prairie Public is participating in Giving Hearts Day, the largest 24-hour online giving event.
The number of the day is a lot of fun.
Count yourself as a supporter of public media by going to givingheartsday.org. All contributions of $10 or more, up to $5,000, will be matched thanks to the Newman's Own Foundation.
The real cool hand.
So say, count me, and give to worthy organizations that reflect your values on Giving Hearts Day this Valentine's Day.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. During the Depression, Franklin Delano Roosevelt proposed something he called the New Deal. It created a range of social programs that still are with us today. Well, last week at a Capitol Hill news conference, the Green New Deal was unveiled. And in today's commentary, Mark Trahant wonders if the United States is ready to address climate change and what the impact might be on Indian Country.
A story from the Quinault Nation is chilling. Have we eaten our last blueback? Let's hope not. This salmon season is closed, and we are now the first generation to begin to feel the effects of climate change. This is Trahant Reports. Last week, at a Capitol Hill news conference, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, a Democrat from New York, and Senator Ed Markey, a Democrat from Massachusetts, unveiled the Green New Deal. It's comprehensive legislation that would set the goal of net zero greenhouse gas emissions in a decade. On Saturday, President Donald J. Trump tweeted that Democrats should press forward. It would be great for the so-called carbon footprint to permanently eliminate all planes, cars, cows, oil, gas, and the military, even if no other country would do the same. Brilliant! The Green New Deal raises three big issues. Is the United States finally ready to address climate change? And if so, how? And what would be the impacts on Indian Country? At some point, sooner rather than later, there's really only one question to address. How much does the country and the planet spend on mitigation versus adaptation? Mitigation means trying to slow the impact of humans on the climate by reducing the heat-trapping gases or removing them. Adaptation means everything else, from relocating people, including cities, to managing climate emergencies, ranging from hurricanes and fires to diseases. Just this week, the Quinault Nation had to close its commercial blueback or sockeye salmon fishing for the season. A tribal news release said that warmer ocean temperatures driven by fossil fuels are creating lean times for salmon. It's time to hold oil companies accountable for their past record of denying climate change and their current obstruction of policies to reduce climate pollution, said President Fawn Sharp. The devastation of our iconic blueback salmon has struck at the core of what it means to be Quinault. The politics are complicated. There are essentially three camps in Washington. The first wants action, the position that's found in the Green New Deal. Another group says climate change is important, but preventing a major disruption in the economy is a priority. Go slow. And a third group, led by the White House, dismisses the science and any policy that would slow the rush for American energy dominance. The Green New Deal will not be the final word, even if the legislation makes its way through the House of Representatives, and many Democrats are skeptical. That legislation then must get through a much more centrist Senate. Then even the sponsors get that the specifics of the Green New Deal are not as important as movement. I'm Mark Trahant.
Mark Trahant is the editor of Indian Country Today. You can read more of his work and more about Native issues at IndianCountryToday.com. Coming up on Main Street, Newman's Own Foundation offers Prairie Public supporters an incentive to get involved during Giving Hearts Day.
Hi, I'm Jack Russell Weinstein, host of Why, philosophical discussions about everyday life. We're celebrating our 10th year of radio on Prairie Public with a live taping, music, refreshments, and an exploration of the logic of jazz. Join me and my guest, jazz musician and philosopher, Mark Weinstein, for this free event on Tuesday, February 26th at 7 p.m. at the Empire Arts Center in Grand Forks.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, joined now by phone with Faith Finnelly. She's the grants manager for Newman's Own Foundation, and she joins us from Westport, Connecticut. Faith, thanks for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
Now, the reason we're talking to you is because Newman's Own Foundation has awarded a $50,000 membership challenge grant for us, and we're very pleased about that. Thank you.
Thank you. We're so excited to support Prairie Public, and we love your thoughtful programming, and we're just excited to support you.
And Newman's Own Foundation has a history of supporting public broadcasting, correct?
We do. Newman's Own Foundation has made a commitment to public broadcasting stations across the country. Together, Paul Newman and the foundation have been supporting public broadcasting for more than 35 years. And over those 35 years, we've committed over $16 million to public broadcasting stations across the nation.
Well, Paul Newman, as most of our listeners know, was a fantastic actor, a very well-known movie star. He passed away in 2008, but his wife, Joanne Woodward, remains with us and lives in Westport as well, doesn't she?
That is correct, yeah. And Paul and Joanne both believed in the value of public broadcasting, which is why public broadcasting was among some of the first grants that were made after he launched Newman's Own Salad Dressing Company and decided to give all the profits away to charity.
That's a fascinating story. Let's go back in time and just tell our listeners how Paul Newman got into the salad dressing business and how this became a philanthropic organization.
Yeah, so it started kind of as a joke. Paul Newman and his buddy A.E. Hotchner started making salad dressing in their basement, and then they would give away the salad dressing to their friends and family around the holidays. And then, two, 3 months after the holidays, people would come knocking on their door asking for refills. And somebody joked and said, you know what, Paul and Hotch, you guys should sell this stuff. And one of Paul's business advisors said, if you're ever going to sell any of this, you're going to have to put your face on the label. And that idea was crazy to Paul because he was super humble and he didn't like any attention. But somehow they convinced him to do it. They got him on the shelves in a couple of local stores here in Connecticut, and the products just took off. And what started as salad dressing has now expanded to a whole range of natural food products, including pasta sauce, salsa, popcorn. And it really started as a joke. But in the beginning, he said, if I end up making any money from this, I'm going to give all the profits to charity. And since 1982, we've given over $540 million to charity.
Wow. And A.E. Hotchner is still with us. He's in Westport as well. He's 101 years old now.
That's right. He is.
And many of our listeners would probably recognize the name. He's a pretty well-known novelist and biographer and playwright and screenwriter. So very interesting the way this ball got rolling, if you will, from oil and vinegar to my goodness.
It's true.
So the current source of funding for Newman's Own is product sales?
Yes. So the way that we're set up is 100% of the profits that are generated by the sale of our food products flow into the foundation. And then the foundation gives all of the money away to charities across the world. And one of our focus areas is independent media. And it was access to unbiased and thoughtful news programming was something, as I said, that was really important to Paul Newman, and the foundation is continuing that legacy. And we believe that all people should have access to quality and unbiased news.
Well, we certainly appreciate your pledge of support to us. Does the foundation have an endowment now that's been growing as well, or is it just product sales?
No, we have no endowment. So we are completely reliant on the success of our food products. And so we're only able to give away however much our food company generates in profit. So unlike many other foundations, we truly are, reliant on the success of our food sales. And we've been lucky enough over the last 6-7 years to annually give away between $25 and $30 million.
Wow. Well, Paul Newman and A.E. Hotchner were making salad dressing. So as part of the foundation's enterprise here, keeping ahead of the culinary curve?
Yeah, no, it's always a challenge, and we are always innovating. Our folks working in the food company are tirelessly working on developing new products and keeping it fresh and exciting, and we're competing against some big players in the food space who have huge marketing budgets, which we don't have because we want to keep our overhead to a minimum so that we can give away as much profit to charity. So all of our recipe tasting and all of our focus groups are in-house. Paul Newman never wanted to rely on outside focus groups to decide if a product was good. He trusted the people that work here. So we get to taste test in-house in our test kitchen, and we have some really talented food scientists here who are, again, constantly innovating with new products.
So let's talk about Newman's Own Foundation and its mission and what kinds of enterprises, philanthropic enterprises it supports.
So we, our mission is to nourish the common good, and we do that through four core focus areas. The first one is nutrition. So we believe that all people deserve access to healthy and affordable food. So we support a lot of programs that provide fresh food access and nutrition education in underserved communities here in the United States. We also have another focus called Children with Life-Limiting Conditions. And this is really kind of centered around the Serious Fun Network of camps, which started as one camp for seriously ill kids here in Connecticut that Paul Newman started called the Hole in the Wall Gang Camp. And this allows seriously ill kids to just unwind and be kids for a week every summer. Many of them are so sick that they spend most of their year in the hospital.
Well, most people would remember the Hole in the Wall in the Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid movie.
Exactly. And Paul I think that these camps were in many ways the heart of Paul's philanthropy. He really had a soft spot for children who were seriously ill. So that remains one of our core focuses. And in addition, we have our empowerment focus, which is pretty much supporting any organization that uplifts people who are trying to overcome extraordinary circumstances. So within that, we have our veterans and military portfolio, and we really have refined that to focus specifically on veteran entrepreneurship and access to quality higher education for the veteran community. Because Paul Newman was a World War II Navy vet, he felt very passionately about taking care of our vets and their families and caregivers.
And of course, you gave us the part of the mission was encouraging philanthropy, and we certainly appreciate that because that will help Prairie Public and our listeners and viewers and the people who use our educational services as well. Philanthropic organizations are required to file documents that amount to proof of performance. You've suggested you've got a pretty lean, mean operation here. You've got a food company and all that too. How does Newman's Own stack up in terms of its efficiency?
Yeah, so I think you hit the nail on the head. I mean, because we're trying to keep our operation as lean and mean as possible, we're a very small staff. So our grants team is only 5 people, and we make over 800 grants a year. So it's kind of a it's a really close-knit team because we all have to wear several different hats, mm-hmm. and all of us roll up our sleeves and help out with a variety of different things. And I have to say, I've never worked with such a hardworking team where everyone is willing to just dig in and help out because we are such a small staff. And, yeah, we're incredibly efficient.
Well, 800 grants a year with a group of 5, that is a lot of work.
It is.
Paperwork.
We have transferred to electronic systems now, but Paul Newman hated computers, I've heard. So it took a while to convince him to actually get computers in our office and even get office furniture. When the office was first opened in 1982, some of my colleagues were there when we were just starting out, and he took the pool furniture from his backyard and brought it into the office. And Joanne went out to the pool and she said, "Where's all the furniture?" And he brought like the plastic lawn chairs and the plastic table into the office. So we actually have one of the original pieces of plastic chaise lounge in our office to remember.
Well,
remember him.
That's sweet. Nevertheless, whether it's on paper or in a computer, it's a lot of words and a lot of data. So there's a lot of stuff to keep track of. Are Newman's Own Foundation grants one time, or can they be sustaining?
Yeah. So typically, our grants are for a 1-year period. And you know, unfortunately, we are not able to guarantee funding from 1 year to the next. And much of that is due to the fact that, as I said, we do not have an endowment. So we are, you know, we're always kind of reliant on how well our food business does. That being said, many of our grantees do end up receiving renewal grants, but typically grants do have a 1-year grant period.
Well, I'm happy to tell you that we see Newman's Own products on store shelves everywhere around where I live, and I hope that's the case everywhere in the United States because it's such a good cause. What kind of follow-up do you do with the grants that you do give out?
Yeah, so it depends on which grant it is. We have, again, with 800 grantees a year, it's impossible to even have conversations with every single one, and I think part of our philosophy as grant makers is that we are not the experts. We believe that the folks who are running these nonprofits and doing the good work in the field, they're the experts, and they're the one. And we put a lot of faith in the nonprofit organizations to which we make grants. And so, you know, I would say that we don't see ourselves as a heavy-handed funder that has a lot of requirements for reporting and things like that. Certainly, with some of our much larger and multi-year grants we do for reporting, but I'd say that for some of our smaller grants, we, in good faith, we kind of give the money in good faith and know that the organizations are doing the best that they can.
Just before we started this conversation, you told me that this day was your 6th anniversary with Newman's Own Foundation. So talk about you, Faith. How did you get into the philanthropy field?
Yes, today is my 6-year anniversary at Newman's Own Foundation, and it's been just such a quick 6 years. It's flown by. And before this, I was working in the nonprofit sector, so I never thought that I would have an opportunity to work as a funder. But my background was in nonprofit, and specifically kind of international humanitarian aid and human rights work. And Yeah, it's been 6 years now of doing this work. But I think my nonprofit experience is really, really valuable in this role because I have a little bit of perspective into how hard people in nonprofits are working and also how understaffed and under-resourced they are many times.
Well, as you mentioned, this is a very unique foundation because of its source of funding. Is there sort of a long-range vision for the organization?
I mean, I think it's just to continue to give it all away for as long as we can. And that's like actually another one of Paul Newman's famous quotes was, if we ever have a plan, we're screwed. And we literally have this. We have this quote framed and hanging up in our boardroom. And I mean, it is a bit of a lighthearted thing, but and we do certainly plan. I don't want to give the impression that we're completely disorganized, but there is a bit of kind of we're doing the best we can, and we really do hope that we can continue to give it all away for as long as possible, and while constantly innovating, not just on the food business side and on the product development side, but on the way that we make grants and the way that we engage with our partners in the nonprofit space.
Well, again, our thanks to you on behalf of Prairie Public for Newman's Own Foundation's support of public broadcasting across the country and specifically across North Dakota and northwest Minnesota. We're very appreciative of your support, and we hope that our listeners who are so inclined will take part in helping us leverage this support from Newman's Own by Giving Hearts Day and helping other organizations, because there are literally hundreds of them that are covered by Giving Hearts Day across the state of North Dakota and elsewhere. So this is a great reminder that philanthropy is very important in our country, and thank you, Faith, for what you do.
Thank you for having me today, and we are so happy to support Prairie Public. Thank you.
Faith Finley is the grants manager for Newman's Own Foundation. Dakota Datebook is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by the Radisson Hotel in downtown Fargo, featuring a Valentine's package February 14th through the 16th that includes a guest room, four-course dinner for two, and wine or a sparkling cider delivered to your room. 701-232-7363 or RadissonFargo.com.
Listen to our podcast or a previous broadcast anytime, anywhere. In your home or on your phone, you can catch Main Street on any street. All day, all night, a friend in Fiji or your aunt in Vermont can tune into a show you just know they'd want to hear, or they can browse older shows for other topics of interest. Our app and archives are easy to find. They're right on Main Street, in the radio neighborhood at prairiepublic.org.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 13th, Remembering Theodore Roosevelt, featuring the words of Roosevelt as read by Steve Stark. 24-year-old Theodore Roosevelt suffered a sorrow of volcanic proportions in February of 1884. Responding to an urgent cable from his brother, T.R. hastened from Albany to New York City, where his wife Alice lived with his mother, Mittie. Alice was in a dangerous state of health after giving birth to their first child. In another room, Mittie was on the threshold of death from Bright's disease. Roosevelt lost the two most important women of his life before dawn. In his February 14th diary, he penned, "The light has gone out of my life." Broken in spirit, he sought solace months later in the alluring place he had discovered the previous year in the far west of Dakota Territory. Western Dakota's rugged backcountry, rivers, landscapes, and people helped set the stage for the healing drama that would change Roosevelt's life forever.
I have always said I would not have been president had it not been for my experience in North Dakota. It was here that the romance of my life began. I grew very fond of this place, and it certainly has a desolate, grim beauty of its own that has a curious fascination to me. There are no words that can tell the hidden spirit of the wilderness, that can reveal its mystery, its melancholy, and its charm. I do not believe there was any life more attractive to a vigorous young man than life on a cattle ranch in those days. It was a fine, healthy life, too. It taught a man self-reliance, hardihood, and the value of instant decision. I enjoyed that life to the fullest.
Roosevelt elaborated in a letter from Dakota to his friend Henry Cabot Lodge.
I heartily enjoy this life with its perfect freedom. There are few sensations I prefer to that of galloping along those rolling, limitless prairies with rifle in hand, or winding my way along the barren, fantastic, and grimly picturesque deserts of that so-called Badlands.
Today's Dakota Datebook was written and performed by Steve Stark. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the Historical Society of North Dakota. This series with funding from the Theodore Roosevelt Medora Foundation.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative of Bismarck, a consumer-owned power cooperative and owner of a large coal-based carbon capture project in Beulah, North Dakota, with nearly 35 million metric tons of CO2 captured.
In the years since the Parkland shooting, one survivor is still trying to find balance in her life.
It's very hard to have a normal high school experience while we still go to Stoneman Douglas, and that's just what the reality is.
She's class president, but she's also the outreach director for March for Our Lives. Her story this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered starts at 4 Central, 3 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
Hey, do you have a guest idea, a comment, or a question? It's easy to contact us. You can email us at mainstreet@prairiepublic.org or on Facebook, we're Main Street at Prairie Public. Or you can call us toll-free, 888-755-6377. We want to hear from you.
Thursday on Main Street, chronic wasting disease affecting deer is seen as a potential threat to humans. We'll learn about the growing concern from Michael Osterholm, director of the University of Minnesota's Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy. We'll also discuss healthy breakfasts with Sue Balcom in our weekly Main Street Eats discussion, and we'll share our What's Happening calendar of events. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Thursday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.